Luke chapter 7, Luke's Gospel chapter 7. That's where we're going to take up a story and think about together in our time together today. Luke chapter 7 in your Bibles. Good to see you. Glad that you are here. Encouraged by your presence and your interest in the things of God. Fascinating story, Luke's Gospel chapter 7. One of the lesser known, lesser remembered stories of Jesus' ministry. After he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. And when the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly, saying, "He's worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation. He is the one who built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. And when he was not far from the house, a centurion then sent friends, saying to Jesus, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed." Stop right there for just a minute. Usually, when we read this story, and most of us remember this story, this is one of those miracle healing stories. Jesus is going to heal the centurion's servant. It's part of Jesus building his messianic resume. He could do the great works of God. It's a sign that God is with him. And we recognize that part of the story and how this story fits that role in the gospel. And we also get how it shows that Jesus is even being understood by those who aren't Jews. In fact, many Jews are rejecting him. But here's a centurion, a Roman occupier, a pagan Gentile, who recognizes that he's, in one sense, not worthy. He recognizes Jewish custom, that Jews are defiled when they go into Gentile homes. And so that's why he did not dare approach Jesus himself. He sent Jewish leaders to talk to Jesus, Jews talking to Jews. And then he doesn't want Jesus actually come into his house because that would be embarrassing and awkward for Jesus. He's a pagan who gets Jesus. And so we appreciate the humility and the faith. We talk about the faith sometimes. But the reason I've come to this story this morning is what happens next. We get all that. We've seen that before. But look at what happens next. This is a unique statement in the Gospels, in the stories of Jesus. "I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof." He's not the only guy who doesn't think he's worthy of Jesus. But what comes next is remarkable. "I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. Therefore, I didn't presume to come to you. But say the word and let my servant be healed. For I too," and here's the phrase that's going to get us this morning, "I too am a man set under authority. I have soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." And when Jesus heard these things, not the first part where it's that whole, you know, "You're Jewish, I'm Gentile, it's awkward, I don't want to make it awkward for you," and so forth. It's not just a matter of he has faith. Jesus is just marveling he has faith when so many don't. What Jesus is, I think, particularly marveling at is the man understands something deep and profound. The man understands authority. That's how he recognizes Jesus. It's not just bread and circuses for him. It's not just, "Here's a guy who can solve my earthly problems. Here's a guy I can come to and he makes my life easier." Boy, isn't that why a lot of people come to Jesus then and now? We come to Jesus because you know, my yoke is easy and my burden is light and he's going to help you live your best life now. We come to Jesus because he's going to make our life easier and do things for us. And the centurion says, "No, I know you can do this because I understand authority. See, I'm a centurion, so that means I've got a general above me and a Caesar above him, and I've got men below me. I understand hierarchy. I understand roles. I understand authority." That's the crucial part of the story. The centurion connects his faith in Jesus with an appreciation of an authority and the dignity of the office of the Messiah of God. And those are concepts that many in our culture do not grasp and do not want to grasp. Given the natural human inclination to resist authority, our culture has made the disdain of authority in our time and place into a virtue. Think about that. Think about that. In our culture, we have long defined freedom as "no one can tell me what to do," starting with the government on down. we are defined in our culture by individual autonomy. Everybody has their rights. Nobody should be limited or controlled in any way. Nobody should be constrained in any manner. And so now what we have, think about the world that we live in now. You want to know why human resources departments are burgeoning bureaucracies in so many companies and so many workplaces? It's because we have to create ever-growing bodies of policies and procedures to try to smooth over the friction and the frustration of workplaces populated by people who collectively want to have no limits and no inconveniences placed upon them. And so we go and complain about our boss. He hurt my feelings. We go and complain about our coworkers. They got in my lane. They're out of control, or they're saying things that are offensive to me. With such a mindset, it's no wonder that the marriage rate is down and marriage is impossible. Marriage is impossible with such a mindset. Nobody wants to submit to authority or accept limits on their life and what they can do. Family is impossible with such a mindset. Children don't want to listen to parents. Country and government are impossible in such a mindset. If there's no authority, there can't be a government. No respect for authority. And even the congregation of a local church becomes impossible without the respect for authority. Our movies and our entertainment celebrate the person who does it their own way. And by the way, moms and dads, that includes even the Disney movies that we allow to shape our children's minds when they are young. A rejection and rebellion against authority held up as a virtue. Think about it. You ever thought of The Little Mermaid? Man, that's classic Disney. That's 30 years ago. That was like the beginning of the second golden age. Remember The Little Mermaid? Think about that story for a second. Teenage girl disrespects father to her best friend, who happens to be a fish, by the way. Father decides to rebel against them, date the guy she's not supposed to be dating. It all nearly ends badly when she's taken advantage of by somebody who's evil but cleverer than she is. And at the end of the story, she marries the guy anyways, and dad's the one who's learned a lesson. Think about that and wonder next time why your kids talk back to you after watching Disney. A little tongue-in-cheek there, but not a whole lot, folks. Think about the messages even of what we think are moral and up and clean movies, just because there's no cussing, no sex, and no nudity. Rebellion against authority goes all the way back to the garden, but in our time, in our place, we have made it a virtue. And so we live in a world in which young people enjoy telling each other stories of how they told off or ignored their manager at work. And we live in a world in which a man who learns that there was a county or city ordinance against burning things on in his backyard decides to take the attitude, no one tells me what to do in my property. How about my body, my choice? Well, that one's made a comeback lately. What about the teenager who snickers at the older person with their decaying bodies and declining minds? The teenager who laughs because they're doing something awkward, because they're not in their right health and right mind anymore. What about the student who disrespects the teacher who is merely, and when they do so, is merely imitating their parent who shows no respect to their boss? And so again, it's no wonder there's so much social unrest today. So much political unrest today, why so many families and marriages are so unstable. Listen to me this morning. Without the structure of and submission to authority, families will be in chaos, society will become anarchy, and even closer to home, maybe even in this room this morning, the church, the local congregation, will become a worldly place full of false teaching, unscriptural beliefs, and ungodly practices. That's what happens. The Bible shows us over and over again when authority is not respected. And even in your own individual life, when you don't respect authority, then that means you won't respect God's authority either. And you won't take the Bible seriously. What you'll wind up doing is you'll wind up picking and choosing what you want to hear out of the Bible, the happy parts, where Jesus does good things for us but demands nothing of us. And we'll wind up ignoring and explaining away the parts of the Bible that require us to submit to God, submit to Jesus, and change our lives in hard and painful ways, which we're not inclined to do. There can be no authority in a sentimental and emotionally driven world where how something makes us feel or what makes us happy is the ultimate authority. Where individual choice is the highest value. Where people say it doesn't matter what I do as long as I am true to myself. And naturally turns what should be authoritative arrangements, whether it's the school, the workplace, or even the local congregation, into basically competing individuals and competing groups who strive to gain legitimation and market share by catering to consumer choice. The people have spoken, so that's what we need to do. And so schools lower standards and workplaces become chaotic and churches refuse to hold the line that God has drawn because we don't want to lose people who don't want to submit to authority. It's interesting in the Bible, book of Deuteronomy. Remember, Paul calls it the first command with promise, honor thy what? Father and mother. It's one of the, as I like to call them, the 10 really big ideas. We often call them the 10 commandments. But the reality is they're, in the Hebrew, they're called the 10 words or the 10 things. They're the 10 really big ideas. These ideas, rightly understood, become definitive of how the world works and how God expects us to live. And it starts with our relationship towards God, trickles down to our relationship to each other. Honor thy father and mother. It's interesting what the book of Deuteronomy does with that, and we miss that. We're not going to unpack that this morning, but I just want you to see that. What the book of Deuteronomy does is it takes each of those 10 big ideas, and a lot of the rest of the laws in Deuteronomy are meant to be showing how these 10 ideas spin out in specific and often unexpected ways when you learn what God really meant when he says this. And when you get to the part of Deuteronomy that's really God spinning out and fleshing out what's meant by honor thy father and mother, what it is it's really about respect for authority. Children learn to respect authority at home when they respect their parents and learn to obey them. And then when they grow up, guess what they know how to do? They know how to show respect for authority in a larger society. They know how to respect the authority of judges. They know how to respect religious authority, respect for priests. Ultimately, they know how to respect the government itself, kingship, and down the line to eventually even the authority of prophets itself. Children learn how to view God from how they learn how to view their parents from their earliest days at home. Do you understand that this morning? That's what God was trying to tell Israel thousands of years ago. It starts at home, and when it doesn't happen at home, when it's not taught at home, when it's not expected at home, when it's not disciplined at home, guess what happens? Well, look outside. That's what happens. When marriages and families crumble, when the families that exist do not enforce authority and respect for authority, we get chaos. And God has wanted us to understand it from the beginning. And so here's the thing. I want to do a couple of things in the time that I have together this morning. I want to go back and I want to hit what the Bible says. Not about all spheres of authority in the Bible, but I want to talk about several spheres of authority in the Bible where God has said there is authority here and you need to respect it. God has drawn the lines. God has granted authority. God has placed authority in the world. And God expects us to respect that. And so let me start this morning with just the older and the younger. God expects the younger to respect the older. The older have in theory authority simply because they've been here longer, and young people, they are the reason you are here. They built the world you are inheriting. And yes, we sometimes want, in our youthful arrogance, want to blame them for what's wrong with the world, but guess what? It's always a fallen world, young people. It's always a fallen world. And by the way, you take that attitude, don't be surprised when you're the grandparent if the young people now look at you the same way. It's been fascinating for me at my age because I remember the boomers when they were young because I am a child of the boomer generation, and now the boomers are old. And it's fascinating to watch the Zoomers, the Gen Z kids, saying to the boomers, okay, boomer. Because the original anti-authoritarian generation as a generation in America was what? The boomers, right? Remember, trust nobody over 30? Remember, some of us have been around a little longer. Remember that? Yeah. But in the Bible, age inherently has authority. It's how the younger generation got here. They built what the younger generation inherits. And think about in the Bible, so many places where the Bible indicates things go badly when the young do not respect the implicit authority of the older. I think about stories like in 1 Kings chapter 12, remember when Rehoboam becomes king, and rather than listening to the aged, older, wiser men that served his father Solomon, who's now dead, 1 Kings 12 tells us that Rehoboam abandoned the counsel of the old men and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. And how that story worked out? Spectacularly. He only split a kingdom and literally created the situation that prevailed up until the Messiah's time. But even beyond that, listen to what Scripture itself says. Besides examples like Rehoboam of what happens when the young fail to appreciate and respect the aged and the older, wisdom and experience. Luke chapter 19, verse 32, God said, listen, young people, God said, you shall stand up before the gray head and honor the face of an old man. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You hear what he's saying? You do that because you fear me, but it's also a sense of showing you do understand what it is to fear me. If you can show respect to somebody who's older and been here longer than you, and in one sense, whether it's your father or or whether it's just somebody who's aged, who's built the world that you are inheriting, to show that you recognize that you receive that which you did not create, shows that you understand how it is to submit to God, from whom we receive that which we did not create. Think about Job 32 and verse 6, where Elihu, son of Barakel, the Buzzite, answered and said to Job and his three friends, and listen to this morning. I am young in years, and you all are aged. Therefore, I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. Isn't that something? And by the way, were the older men getting it wrong in that book, in that story? Yeah. Yeah, Job's three friends made a huge mess of things. And here's Elihu, young guy, sitting there the whole time. He's got better answers. He's got a better perspective, by the way. The Bible seems to imply that. But what does Elihu say, even though he is correct about some things he will say? I was really slow to speak because you guys are older and aged and I am not. Think about that. I think about Proverbs 16, verse 31. Gray hair is a crown of glory. It is gained in a righteous life. I think about Proverbs 20 and verse 29. The glory of young men is their strength. When you're young, you're still healthy and can do stuff. But the splendor of old men is their gray hair. You've learned a few things that you don't know when you're young, and are therefore a more well-rounded person because of the experience of life. Ultimately, I think about Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 5, where Isaiah describing what a society in its death throes in a downward spiral looks like. People will oppress one another. Yep, I see that. I get that. One will oppress his fellow, and everyone will oppress his neighbor. But look at the next part. And youth will be insolent to the elder. And young people will be insolent to the older ones. God built the world in such a way, folks, and especially young people this morning, built the world in such a way that we owe respect to the aged. Even when they're mistaken, we owe them respect. There's a right and a wrong way to correct somebody who's older than us when they're wrong. Paul talks about this to Timothy. You speak to older men as though they are fathers. You show them respect even when you have to correct them, because there's an inherent authority that the older have over the younger. That's number one. Number two. Husbands and wives. Oh, yeah, that one gets awkward. Husbands and wives. But here's the thing we've got to understand. There is literally, it's not just a matter of for good social order. And even though God says so, and that's part of it, here's the issue of authority in marriage. Here's the issue of authority in marriage. It's this. God himself says the order of authority in marriage is not for its own sake. It is an image of something else, right? What is it an image of? It's an image of two things. It's an image of the nature of creation itself. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 reminds us that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband. The head of Christ is God. That's the thing. God, Jesus under God in his incarnational state where he chooses to submit himself to the will of the Father. So God to Christ, Christ to man to woman. And that goes back to creation itself, because as Paul points out in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 8, man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Now, yes, Paul goes on to remind men don't get cocky, because ever since then, every man's been born of a woman. But there's an order, there's a hierarchy there that goes back to creation itself. This is how God literally brought the world into being. And then secondly, most of you know this, in Ephesians chapter 5, in a passage where Paul is affirming hierarchy in many spheres of life. Hierarchy, order, and authority in many spheres of life. He says that wives are to submit yourselves to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. And so marriage was not made for our happiness first and foremost. God designed marriage to be an image of what he is up to in creation towards eternity. He was creating a people, Christians embodied in the church, that would be the bride of Jesus. We submit to Jesus as human beings, as Christians, as members of the church, and so too wives were to submit to husbands as images of that reality. God likes images. He doesn't like us making images. Those are called idols. But God likes images that he's built them into creation. And that's what marriage is. And so we play our roles in marriage not because men always get it right or women are inherently inferior. We play our roles because these are the roles we have been assigned for the image that God has created. Do you understand that this morning? And the challenge that structure, as so many will do in our culture, is to not just disobey God, it's to literally challenge the structure of reality as God has created it, is redeeming it, and perfecting it. And so we have husbands and wives, and as long as we're in Ephesians, and of course we have parents and children, right? We have that one as well. Children, Ephesians 6, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and you may live long in the land. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And so again, there's authority there, and it's God-granted authority. Children, you do this because it is right. This is how reality works. And when this doesn't happen, just as we looked at Deuteronomy, when children don't learn this at home, then society is doomed. You cannot build a human society, whether it's the local church, the school, the workplace, a government, a nation. You can't do it without respect for authority. And it starts at home. Well, and then there's this one. Oh, there's government individuals. Oh, that gets touchy in this day and age, doesn't it? Half the country is always upset one direction or the other over who's in charge. And more half the country refuses to submit to the authority of the other half when they're not in charge. This isn't going to end well, folks. And the problem is too many Christians have absorbed the mindset and joined in the mob. And yet, Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13, be subject for the Lord's sake, you hear that? Be subject, be in submission for the Lord's sake. Not because every institution always gets it right. Not because everybody with authority always makes the right decision or even does what is just. You do it, why? For the Lord's sake. Underline, highlight, circle that. Burn that into your heart and mind. That's why you do it. Not because authority figures always get it right, but because God said so. And so be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it's to the emperor as supreme or as to governors sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. That's the ideal. Doesn't always happen. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants. Honestly, the word ought to be translated slaves. We just don't like that word anymore for legitimate reasons. But we ought to be slaves of God under his authority. That's why we do this. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. And as I've said before, and I'll say again, and Peter wrote those words about an emperor who would put him to death about 2 years after he wrote this. Think about that. Well, he's going to make the wrong decision. Yeah, he might. Why do you submit? For the Lord's sake. Well, they're going to get away with it. Do you believe in the judgment day or not? Nobody gets away with anything, folks. Nobody gets away with anything. And so here's Jesus, John chapter 19. Here's a story to, again, understand what it looks like. Authority. John chapter 19, beginning of verse 10, where Jesus is literally on trial for his life. And there is injustice and abuse of authority all over the story of the crucifixion of Jesus, isn't there? All sorts of abuse of authority and injustice all over the story because the innocent man is about to die, falsely accused, falsely convicted. And when Jesus is standing before Pilate, Pilate asks him in verse 10, he says, you will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? Jesus, don't you know who you're dealing with here? I have power. I have authority. And by the way, is Pilate technically correct? Yes, he is. Whatever Pilate says, whatever Pilate decides, determines what happens next. It is his decision to make. He does have that authority. Look at what happens, though, in Jesus' answer. Verse 11, Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Boy, there's a lot going on in those two sentences, but it's the first sentence alone I want to focus on this morning. Notice what Jesus is saying there. Think about this. You have no authority over me at all unless it has been given you from above. Where did Pilate get his authority? Well, you say Caesar. Yeah, but I don't think Jesus just means Caesar. Where does all authority come from? That's legitimate. It comes from God. And what is Jesus saying to Pilate? It's really not your decision. Your job is to ultimately use authority correctly according to the one who gave it to you. And Pilate understands this because the text makes clear as we keep reading, Pilate got scared at that point. Because he understood what Jesus was talking about as well. It's not just Caesar getting mad at him for not doing his job right. The ultimate source of all authority is God. And we're accountable to him, even when we have legitimate God-given authority. And so Jesus submits to Pilate's decision while reminding Pilate, you're going to be held accountable someday too for the authority you've been given. It's not just your authority, Pilate. And then what about this one? Elders and members in the local church. What about this sphere of authority that has been established and ordained by God? Where the Hebrew writer rather says in Hebrews 13 and verse 17, listen now, obey your leaders and submit to them. You hear that, folks? Doesn't mean you can't talk to the elders or share your concerns with them or ask questions. But at the end of the day, you obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. Similarly, Paul, 1 Thessalonians 5, beginning of verse 12, we ask you, brothers, to respect those who labor among you and over you in the Lord and admonish you, to esteem them highly in love because of their work. And so here's the thing we got to understand, folks. Ultimately, all of these various relationships remind us that all of us have someone we submit to at some point. And that ultimately, all of us, through the various levels of authority that God has placed in the world, that various ones of us sometimes have authority given by God. Some of us are sometimes called to submit to authority under God and the one to whom he has delegated it. But ultimately, all of us are submitting to God as we do this. Everybody answers to somebody. Do you understand that this morning? Because even going back to Hebrews 13 and verse 7, let them do this as those who give an account. That there's a sense in which I answer to the elders right now. The elders answer to God. Everybody answers to somebody. You understand? Because that's the problem sometimes. We look at it, we say, submission, and nobody should have authority. And no, everybody answers to somebody, even those who have authority in some sphere. Everybody answers to somebody. And so here's the thing. Here's the thing, and I want you to understand. We are so good at quickly pivoting when we start talking about these areas, whether it's marriage or government. We are so good at quickly pivoting to all the caveats and all the qualifications and all the exceptions to submission to authority in these spheres. We're so good at it, in fact, that eventually what actually happens when you stop and think about it, eventually what happens is that the commandments themselves come to mean nothing, and the principles are so watered down and qualified away that there's nothing hardly left to submit to. Isn't that what we do? And why do we do that? Part of why we feel so strongly about whether it's wives' submission to husbands or individual submission to the government or members' submission to elders is because these commandments sting. Because they run so counter to human nature and our fallenness, to human culture and our rebelliousness, to our sinful hearts. The truth at root of more than any of these particular categories is that we don't want to submit to God. And so we find exceptions to when we can lie. Well, that's to save my job. Or we find exceptions to when we can divorce or remarry. Well, God wouldn't really want me to spend the rest of my life alone, we'd say. You see, when we practice finding exceptions to submission all the way through so many other spheres of life, it's no wonder that when it comes to us and God, we do the same thing. Do you see that this morning? Do you understand that? The desire for extensive qualifications and caveats is inherently destructive of what are supposed to be defining principles. Overqualifying things and all these caveats, they obscure the purpose for which commandments and authority exist. What ultimately happens is the way we pursue all the caveats and exceptions and qualifications is we are destroying authority. We are bringing authority back under our control rather than submitting to somebody else's control, chiefly God's. And what that does in time is it leads to the very spirit of Satan himself in the garden who posed the question, has God really said? Has God really said submit to the government? Has God really said submit to the elders? Has God really said we should submit and show respect to the aged? Has God really said wives should submit to husbands, children to parents? That might scar a child for life who never learns to be creative and independent. Has God really said? But at the end of the day, he's talking about government, but the key phrase is found right here. As Paul calls us to submit to government, there is no authority except from God. And so if God has delegated authority, folks, to rebel against it is to rebel against God. That's Paul's point. Whether it's government, marriage, family, church, any other sphere of life where God has granted somebody, some group authority, to resist the authorities that God has delegated is to resist God himself. Has God really said, we ask ourselves too often, when it comes to submitting to authority? And so as our time winds down this morning, let me make four quick observations about authority, four quick observations, and we're going to be done. Number one, there will be authority or there will be chaos. There will be authority or there will be chaos. Think about it this way. That's the nature of creation itself. You go all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. And what's the first way that the creation is described? It was formless and it was void. And then what happens? God begins speaking, and then speaking, God begins ordering. And so he separates the light from the darkness. That's the thing. He's separating, right? He's putting things into spheres. And by the way, go back and read Genesis even. The sun to have authority over the day on day four, and the moon and the stars by night to have authority. That the relationships of hierarchy and structure and authority, they're part of creation itself. Otherwise, everything is formless and void. God brings order and structure and authority and hierarchy to creation. He did it with gender when he made us male and female, but he didn't just make us male and female at once. He made the man. He spoke to the man. He commanded the man. The man started his work with naming, and he made woman out of man to be helper to him, but submissive to him in that helping role. Because as Paul reminds us again, woman came out of man. It's the nature of creation itself. And when we begin to bend gender roles or even gender identity now, and by the way, is it any wonder that we first played with gender roles so that now gender identity means nothing? Once you begin to say there's no difference between male and female in our roles, there's going to be no difference in male and female in our identities. No wonder the kids are so confused. Because we've been doing this for decades in this country, even in homes among Christians and even in the church, where we get soft on this, we get confused on this. And certainly without authority, there will be chaos in society. What's the refrain at the end of the book of Judges? A dark book in the Bible, a dark book in which there was so much sin, so much violence, people oppressed. What a mess the book of Judges is. Well, the book of Judges says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and so what happened? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There will be authority or there will be chaos. There must be a place of authority where judgments are ultimately be made and standards are accountably enforced, where people answer to a standard giver rather than just following the mob of the rebellious, the immature, and the grumblers. There will be authority or there will be chaos. But people, again, don't like authority because that means I'm going to have to accept and submit to imposed limits on what I want to do. It means I'm going to live with fewer options of what I can do. And yes, to be sure, being under authority does mean I may suffer because of others' abuse of authority. But God, therefore, doesn't invalidate the principle of authority. He just says in 1 Peter 4 and verse 19, therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator and doing what is good. You keep submitting anyways and let God deal with it. Boy, is that politically incorrect to hear these days. No caveats, no exceptions. Let's just leave the Bible the way God wrote it. Do you believe that God is a faithful Creator or not? Number two, the rebellious will always grumble against authority. That doesn't mean that authority is illegitimate. It just means that there are some people who are rebellious. By its very definition, if authority is exercised, not everybody gets their way. It's called submission because sometimes people don't want to do it. People don't want to do what the government decides, etc. It's not submission if we all agree because we're all on the same page. Yeah, let's all do it. Don't even need a leader for that. Don't even take a vote. But the rebellious will always grumble against authority. I think about Numbers chapter 12 where Moses, doing what God told him to do, filling the role that God placed him in, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses. And they said, has indeed the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? We want a share of the authority. We want some say-so, Moses. Remember what happens in the story? God strikes Miriam with leprosy. Ironically, one of the signs back in earlier in Exodus that God had given Moses to work if people doubted his authority. How do you really know? Moses asked God, how will I show them? How will they know that you've really sent me? Well, there's that whole serpent staff thing. That's pretty cool. But there's also this one that he never used before, that whole putting his hand in, making it leprous, and so forth. Well, that's why he struck Miriam with leprosy. Underscore the point. You've spoken against the man I gave authority to. And those of us who are called to exercise authority in our various roles in life need to understand that just because people are unhappy doesn't necessarily mean we are doing it wrong. Especially in an anti-authoritarian age. Adults, we need to be authority figures to young people and not apologize for it. And young people, you need to respect authority figures and not make them feel guilty about it. Number three, having authority is actually a heavy responsibility when done right. The reason we are jealous of those who have authorities because we think like the Gentiles. Like, remember in the Gospels when Jesus says, you know, it shall not be so among you. Don't use authorities. He's talking to his 12. Don't use it like the way the Gentiles do where they lord it over each other. Lording it over each other doesn't mean exercising authority when people disagree with you. Lording it over each other means using authority for your own personal benefit. That's what Jesus is talking about. Because by the way, did Jesus lord it over people? Did he assert authority over people who disagree with him? Yeah. You ever seen that scene when he drives the money changers out of the temple? Oh, so much for servant leader Jesus. Makes some people mad when he used his God-given authority as Messiah to cleanse the temple of God where God is worshipped. Made people mad that day. The reason we think of having authority as a perk is because we think the way the world thinks. Having authority is a heavy responsibility when done correctly. Again, back to Moses. I think about Moses back in the book of Numbers, just a page before in chapter 11, right before Miriam and Aaron's rebellion against his authority. Moses in Numbers chapter 11, listen to this story. When Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, the anger of the Lord blazed hotly. Moses was displeased, and Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay all the burden of this people on me?" He's doing his job. He's accepted his job. But you hear what Moses is saying today? It's hard. Having authority to do God's work among these people, it's hard. Did I conceive these people, Lord? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom and be a nurse to them? Where am I to get meat for these people? They weep before me saying, give us meat that we may eat. I'm not able to carry the people alone. The burden's too heavy for me. See, even though Miriam and Aaron thought Moses was lording it over them, Moses wasn't. That grumblers will grumble. And Moses shows that he's rightly using his authority because he feels the burden of it. And hear me well then this morning, because this may be one of the most important things I say. The sacrifice of leadership and having authority is not in doing what others want in spite of yourself. That's that misnomer of that's what servant leadership is. No. The sacrifice is not in doing what others want in spite of yourself. The sacrifice for leaders and those who have authority is in doing what God wants despite what others want and taking the flack for it. That's why those who actually are given authority by God feel the burden of it. The sacrifice is not in doing what others want in spite of yourself. Well, you know, I'm a leader, which means just rubber stamping what everybody else wants. No, the person who's given authority by God is to use it for God's purposes. The sacrifice is in doing what God wants done despite what others want and taking the flack for it. And so that's Moses before God when the people grumble against him. That's Jesus before the chief priests and religious rulers when he exercises authority and speaks authoritatively and then takes the punishment and the abuse and the ultimate death that they dole out. This is what happens, folks, when parents will use their God-given authority before children. Our children will not always thank us for disciplining them, right? One of the things I've said to parents over the years is if your children never cry, you're not doing it right. Well, you know, I want to stay friends with them. No, you're not supposed to be friends with them. You're supposed to be an authority figure to them. They're supposed to learn about authority. You're not their friend. You're a parent. There's a difference. We are supposed to use God-given authority. Those of us who in various spheres of life, like we've talked about this morning, have been granted authority by God, we are supposed to use God-given authority to accomplish others' good and lead them to maturity as defined by God, not them. And so for authority to not become domination, authority must be limited, guided by the appropriate goal or purpose. And the authority, therefore, is to be used to not just do good for others by their definition. It is to be used to bring them to their proper purpose and fulfillment as human beings, as God has defined it. And so you think about, like, for instance, back to marriage. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her and have cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present himself to the church in splendor, spot, wrinkle, or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. What's the goal of a husband's leadership in the marriage? To bring his wife and his children as father to maturity, not to have his way all the time. By the same token, that's why Paul will say to fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. One of the things that happens, folks, in the Bible is when God gives authority, he gives a purpose for which it is to be used. That's a whole other lesson for a whole other day. And that's why, ultimately, when we use our God-given authority, we are not lords, we're not kings determining the purpose of marriage or family or the church. Instead, what we really are stewards. Stewards who do truly have authority, but it's the authority to carry out our master's purpose for his goal and benefit. The authority is real, but there's a difference in a king's authority and a steward's authority. Do you understand that this morning? And God gives us authority as stewards. And that brings me to number four this morning. This is really not just about, wives need to submit to husbands and children need to submit to parents. So that is true. And don't misunderstand me. I'm not in any way taking that down a peg because I think we desperately need that message. But number four is the real take-home point as well this morning. Not exercising the authority God has granted is wrong and sinful too. And so, yes, wives need to submit to husbands, parents to children, members to elders. But in all these other spheres where God has granted authority, to not exercise the authority God has given you is just as wrong. When Moses didn't want the authority back at the burning bush that God was granting him to lead his people out of Egyptian slavery, and Moses kept on waving off and waving off and waving off. Remember the story? What happened? God got angry with Moses because Moses was refusing to use the authority that God had chosen him to wield. And so now I'm not talking to women and children, I'm talking to men. I'm talking to husbands, I'm talking to fathers. Not exercising the authority God has granted us in our realms is sinful, and we will be held accountable to him for that just as much as if we abused our authority. We quickly remember the passage where God tells those under various forms of authority to submit, but we forget about those passages where God has warned, admonished, or judged those to whom he has given authority for not using it well or using it at all. And so I think back to Genesis 3 when God said to Adam, because you listened to the voice of your wife, you were the husband, Adam, you were the leader, and you listened to her rather than correcting and leading and guiding her. I gave you the authority, Adam, and you listened to her. Or I think about Eli in 1 Samuel chapter 3, where as God pronounces judgment on Eli the priest and his house, on that day God says, I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning the judgment of his house from beginning to end, and I will declare to him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity, listen now, for the iniquity that he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. You hear what happens? Eli is in trouble with God because as a father, he knew what his children were doing and he did not correct or discipline them. And God now is holding Eli accountable for that. Fathers, that'll be a verse that keeps you up at night. Stewards, and here's what we got to understand going back to grumblers will always grumble. Stewards are accountable ultimately, not to those below them, but to those who entrusted them with the authority in the first place. And so the men who serve in various leadership roles by God, you can't shirk your authority. But you have to understand as well, why we sometimes do shirk our authority is we don't like the grumbling. We don't like the pushback. I can imagine, can you imagine how the conversation in the garden might have gone between Adam and Eve if Adam had tried to push back and Eve says, oh, you never let me have my way. You always pick where we get to eat. Sometimes we don't wield authority because we don't like dealing with the conflict. But ultimately, stewards answer not to the ones below, but to the one who gave them authority. My job is to return to God, holy and unblemished, God-fearing and righteous, what he has placed under my care. And just like Adam got in trouble in the garden, just like Eli got in trouble at the tabernacle, and so on and so forth it goes. We need to remember that stewards are ultimately accountable not to those below, but to those who gave them the authority. And so Adam didn't answer to Eve in the end, even when he tried to blame it on her. Adam answered to God. And Eli couldn't blame his sons. Eli had to accept his own role in the disaster. And you say, oh, Jeff, you know, what about those who abuse their authority once again? Oh, that's the big caveat. Oh, yeah, I know. But God reminds those who have authority, they'll answer to him. I think about Colossians 4 and verse 1, where Paul says, masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. You will give account of the authority and how you have used it. I think about what God says to elders in Hebrews 13 and verse 17. To the members, the people in the pew, sure, obey your leaders and submit to them. They are keeping watch over your souls. But understand this about elders, and they will, as those who will give an account. See, the elders in one sense don't really answer to us. They answer, they have a far more frightening constituency to whom they are accountable. And it's not you and me. It's God himself. Because everybody submits to somebody at some point. But let's understand and understand well, folks, that God has granted authority in various spheres, and to those to whom it has been granted, not exercising that authority from God is just as wrong as abusing it. And there will be a judgment, and we will be held accountable. And so husbands and fathers, that means we need to pick up the game at home, so be it. But there it is. And so as we close, I think about what Jesus said in John chapter 7, verse 17. He says, if anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and there is no falsehood. That's the essence of how authority is used. That's the essence of how Jesus used his authority on earth. I came to do the Father's will, not to seek my own glory. And it may look like I'm just difficult or harsh or judgmental sometimes, but I answer to God the Father, not you. And folks, unless we firmly and intentionally and authoritatively start setting limits in our homes and our families, unless we intentionally, firmly, and authoritatively recognize the limits that God has placed upon lives and how we're to live them in the church, drift, liberalism, chaos, decay will be the result. The long-term tendency is always towards disintegration, decline, and worldliness. And creation, without God's authority, order deteriorates into chaos. And God has called man to be his image bearer in the sense that we are called by God, stewards of God over all creation, exercise God's delegated authority to hold creation in order the way he has created that. We do that by submitting to and obeying God and accepting the spheres of authority that he has given to us. And part of how, we obey God is we take responsibility and accountability for our authority. And we use it to accomplish his purpose as good stewards of the various aspects of creation and humanity that he has placed under us. To not understand the nature of authority, as Luke 7 reminds us, is to not understand Jesus and his kingdom itself. And so God help us to be people who recognize Jesus, because we are people who get the deep substance of authority, God's and its delegation to us in various ways to maintain his order and accomplish his will in this world. I think we desperately need to return and think and meditate on these things in a world in which we have been shaped to do the very opposite in virtually every sphere of our lives. God help us to be those kind of people, because if you can't recognize authority, you can't recognize Jesus. And if you're here this morning and you need to submit yourself to the authority of King Jesus, by turning your life over to him, by admitting that he is right and you are wrong, you have sinned against him and his will, you have been a traitor to the kingdom of God and how you've lived, but you want to change that now by bending the knee and bowing your head, repenting of your sins, confessing his name, and being baptized for forgiveness of your sins as you enter into his kingdom to be a loyal citizen and servant towards eternity. We'd like to help you with that. You hear this when you're a child of God, but in some way the sin in your life reflects your lack of respect, your lack of obedience to God's authority or one of his delegates' authority in your life. Pray to God for forgiveness, however you've transgressed against him. If you need to share something with the saints or have us pray with you or for you, we'd be happy to do that as well. Why don't you come talk to us while we stand?